fall into that category too, is that, and Ryan brought this up, we've been working on it, and I appreciate all the work you've done, because I couldn't get them to talk to me.
Yeah. I had to yell.
I talked to BCI, and nobody could sit down with me and tell me exactly what they wanted and needed. So thanks to Ryan, I think we've got a clearer picture. And I looked at the CJIS security document. Man, it's crazy, the detail in there. But basically, from an IT standpoint and from a security standpoint, after the way I understand it now, if you're going to store CGI data, you know, BCI and driver's license reports, all that, in the system, it has to be at a higher level of security than we have right now. And the way they say you have to do that is through two-factor authentication, which is becoming a reality for these days. It's just you've got to have more than just a login and a password to secure the data anymore. So where it's being stored in the Amazon Web Services cloud, you know, in their servers there, that's an approved location to store, but you still have to have the right security to get connected to it. So basically what we're doing now is looking at doing two-factor authentication, which is basically you go to log in, and then it says, okay, you need a code. And so it sends, you've got an app on your smart device that gets a code, and it says, here's the code. You put that code in, and then it connects you. So in other words, if somebody has your login and password, they still can't get in without that secondary source of authentication. And that's what they require us to do. So I looked at it. Basically, what it amounts to is if you're only going to use something inside your office that's approved of an approved secure location, you don't need the two-factor authentication. If you're going to use it anywhere that's not a secure location or with a smart device that doesn't have the right controls on it or whatever, you still have to do the two-factor. Essentially, it amounts to most prosecuting offices use it in court or sometimes even from home. You know, because especially the smaller offices, I don't know if it's the bigger offices too, but, and so I think we're going to have to go with two-factor authentication. And it's a little bit more trouble, but I've done some testing I have several places I go to that require the two-factor. It literally takes me 5 to 10 seconds more to log in. And once I'm logged in and active with it, it doesn't require it yet. It's just when you log in.
So The one thing from JTI that I've been talking with them about is it's got to be an either or. We can't only require two-factor authentication when we're outside the office.
Well, yeah, that's right.
It's got to be.
Well, that's the way with the system. If you set up two-factor authentication, it's going to be every time you log in, no matter where you're at. And that was part of the concern.
Some of the other concerns that I noted was that everybody who has to get in has to have a smartphone. They have to be able to have the app.
Well, it doesn't have to be a smartphone. It could be a cheap tablet.
Right. Has to have a mobile device.
All of them have to have an app on it that can get the code. Yeah. And that you then put in the system. So
from the way they described it to me, it seemed like a pain. So I'm glad you've done some testing and it's not that big of a pain.
No, for some people, like I know in Wasatch County, I was talking to them, Scott and them, and there, and they, on their system, their IT people, they got to log in, they got to use a fingerprint or some other kind of authentication to even get on their computer. And then when they go to BCI, it requires a different system, a secondary way of logging in, even though they're already logged in securely. And now this, if you go into here, it's going to require a different thing. So the whole deal is that's the society we're in. That there are hackers out there that want the information, and they want to keep it as secure as they can. So they say this is a requirement.
But the secondary is you have to actually have two separate devices that you're authenticating.
You have your device that's accessing the thing, and then you have another device that gets the code.
So even if you're in your office, sitting at your desk, you have authentication through your computer, and then you have to have your cell phone.
It can be a phone. It can be a little a cheap tablet. It can be, you know, and a tablet can be. And the thing is, almost everybody has phones now. At least that was my idea. I know I found out later there are some people that do not have phones that are capable of having an app on them.
So are all of our assistants going to be required to have city phones?
A cheap tablet that does not have any service.
That can be passed around between all the people.
I don't think it could, because the thing ties you to your...
Individual.
Right.
That's part of the reason why it ties it to an individual. That's why it's more secure that way. It's not just anybody.
And I think that the reason, if we don't store UC just data on it, then you don't need the two-factor authentication. But now, I mean, we're already, when we're sending discovery, we're sending videos separately from, or this would require three things now. You'd have to send your UC just data separate from your office discovery, and then separate from your video.
And my assistants have been doing that. They haven't stored any of it yet, and it's driving both them and the defense attorneys crazy.
Yeah, they're just going off different places. You have to do too many ways of getting them the discovery. Right. So e-prosecutor can give you, just so you're aware of it, it can provide discovery electronically. And for the most part, it works really smooth. There have been a few glitches that we're still working on occasionally, most of it to do with email addresses.
Right, I fixed all
that. You got a problem down there. Yes. We'll work that out. But the problem is, if you don't store CGI data in there, then you have to provide that a different way. So, but if you're going to store it, they're requiring us that we're going to have to go this way. I don't see any other way to avoid it.
And again, it's an either or. Everybody either stores it or not, because there can be access to it. The frustrating thing, I think, is we're exalting form over function here. All of the information that we disclose is public information. I mean, anybody can get convictions.
Yeah.
Anybody can, you know, that kind of thing. But they are crazy. It's like a spy network when you start reading all the requirements. And
when you say that, it's BCI, not us or Journal.
And BCI is going off the FBI's CGI requirements. But I talked to him, I said, this can't be happening with your clients in other states. He says, no, other states don't interpret it quite so literally as Utah.
Yeah. I don't know, but Utah is interpreting it exactly, strictly right down the line. You do it exactly this way, or you don't have access.
So it's a Mandy B. Singer is her name, and I've attempted to contact her several times, and every time I contact her, she sends me back to the state IT guy that I was thinking I could go around and figure out some workaround. But
so who's her boss?
I don't know who
B. Singer. I've had this conversation with BCI so many times, saying all you're doing is all you've done is aggregated public information. Why now is it?
BCI is within the DPS.
Yeah, umbrella, and right? DTS is the driving force.
And it is DTS.
It's not BCI. So if you call them, they're going to say, talk to DTS, because they're the ones that are imposing this.
Oh, yeah.
Which is exactly what I get.
The state.
So you want to talk to Phil Bates.
Just kind of a background. A few years ago, there was a security issue that was a big problem. And ever since then, they've locked down security tighter than it needs to be. But they've overreacted to a security problem a few years ago, and I think that may be part of it. I'm not sure. The bottom line is, I think we have to go this way. So we're going to. I've talked to Journal Technologies about maybe making it. See, our system is for covers every agency that signs on. It's not individual. So if we do two-factor authentication, the server says everybody that has to do it. There's a possibility that we could say this agency only chooses not to, so we won't do it, and then let them deal with the issues on the back end, but we're concerned with that because since it's the same system, then BCI may come back and say, no, everybody does it. So we're thinking that it's just going to be two-factor authentication. It's probably going to be essential down the road. We're going to test it in the development system, two-factor, and make sure that there aren't bugs in that before we roll it out. But bottom line is, if you're storing CGI data and BCI, or whoever is responsible for that data says that you're not compliant, then I don't know what they do. I don't know what the issues are.
Poor BCI access is what they do.
It's no longer access. It's no longer access, I think.
They threaten a lot. I mean, you guys will all remember years ago, and maybe you won't remember. I remember because our city enforced it, when they sent out through the tax that if you have a file, it needs to be locked. And so we had to create a locked file room in our office where all of our files stayed. And if we had files in our prosecutor offices, and we weren't in our office physically, we had to shut our doors and lock them. And I remember that was a big deal, and we all freaked out. And then after a few weeks, we just realized this is the cost of doing business. And I think two-factor authentication, if you want this stuff in online, it's the cost of doing business.
And the nice thing about it is, if it's stored in e-prosecutor, you can provide it to electronic discovery, and it tracks it when they get it. You know when they got it, when they looked at it, and they get it. It's easy for them to go get it.
The discovery portion of the prosecutor is one of its best-selling points, from my perspective.
And so in order to provide that discovery, I think we just have to do that. So that's probably going to be 99.9%. we're just going to enable a two-factor authentication. Just those who don't have a smartphone to do it can get a little tablet. I have a tablet at home that I test with this two-factor with. It cost me literally $50 to buy the tablet, and it can have the app on it that does the authentication part of it. So it's not like it's a huge expense.
I've been doing it with Weaver. I teach for Weaver State. We've been doing it for a couple of years. Community College has been doing it for a couple of years. You can, there are like three options. You can send a push, and then it sends a push to your phone, your computer. And then you can enter a passcode. Now, I don't know if you're supposed to share that passcode, but it gives you a passcode. So there are different ways you can access that information.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy.
With General Technologies, it basically goes through the Google Authenticator apps right now. Yeah. So they're working on doing other ways. But you can also connect other Authenticator apps, I believe. I haven't tested that. But it just you connect it with your login, and when you go to log in, it says, oh, this is you. I'm going to send it to your phone, which is registered, or your device. And you get that code on there, and within 5 minutes, you can put in that code, and it works. If it's more than 5 minutes, then you need a new code. So that's why it's a little more secure. It's a one-time password.
Is it possible to tether the third-party authentication app with the program? In other words, you go to log in, it automatically does the third-party application. That talks to the system, so you never have to do anything.
Yeah, when you set it up, you have the first time you do it, there's a barcode that you have to scan or enter in manually the code, and that connects your phone to your login. And once you've done that, every time you go to log in, the app, you pull up the app, it'll have a code, and then you just put that code in. So
is it possible to bypass the manually entering in the code?
Oh,
I guess that's what I'm asking.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't understand. No, I don't think so. Okay. I think that's part of the deal. There are some systems that actually store, you know, that login that you've been, that you are you and you're authenticating. They keep it until for a certain number of days before you have to do it again. But I don't think General has implemented it that way. It's like every time you log in, you have to put in a new code, which is definitely more secure. Because then if you leave your desk, it goes inactive for a while, then somebody else would need to, even if they're at your computer, they still need that code to get in. So I think that's where we're headed. So given that, as soon as we clean that up as far as test it, make sure it's working, that's probably the way we'll go. It's got to be the way we go, I think, as I looked at it. I don't think, if you're going to store CGI data, I think we have to do that. And I don't think if you don't, I think everybody, Scott and Ryan and Ed, I think you agree that you've got to do that in order to provide discovery properly without causing too much trouble. I think that's kind of the consensus we've come to. So.
Well, it's also what good's having an electronic file management system if you can't have your entire electronic file in there?
Yeah. And we want
criminal histories in me. You know, I'll carry criminal histories in paper form and then my laptop over here.
Yeah. And so just the bottom line as I looked at it, this is, even though there's been some issues and some pain, you guys have been on the bleeding edge is what I call it. You've kind of gone through some pain of being the first ones on. I think that it is, in my opinion, it is leagues ahead of what we have with PIMS as far as its capabilities, its configuration, and its ability down the road to do even more. And just as a quick note, the e-filing with the courts is still being worked through. The courts have been difficult to work with, to say the least. And General Tech is doing their best to get that done. They haven't even got it done for Salt Lake County yet.
That is absolutely true.
And it's not because General Tech isn't putting everything they can into it, it's because it's just difficult to work with the courts to get that done.
Ron, Utah County has it been going for...
Well, I know that's with JustWare, which was done. It's a different way of doing things.
So how do you file your e-filing?
You go on the court's portal and upload your documents to it and go, right now. Eventually, you push a button in e-prosecutor and it'll do all that for you.
Okay.
And they're hoping to be ready by July with that, but he says it's just really hard to tie it down because, I mean, they've made progress and they're getting there, but it isn't quite there yet. And just as a quick...
My money's on the over, not the under.
I agree. That's how it always works, right? The other thing is they have a civil module and a juvenile module. Juvenile, we're at the point where we're ready to plug it in, so you could just, the juvenile will be treated so the cases would all show up in there, one case for one juvenile instead of separate things. That's about ready to plug in. We're just doing some testing on it. The civil module, we're still looking at some configuration issues, making sure we're meeting the needs of the people who do civil work. So once that's in, it'll work for the civil attorneys too, as well as criminal. So that's kind of where we're at, and I had a schedule in there, a deployment schedule I recommended, mostly based on just people who said that have signed their agreements, and also said that the ones who said they'd like it earlier rather than later are the ones that are on the first part of the schedule, because that was their preference. And so, yeah, as soon as we get the two-factor thing worked out, the security thing worked out, we'll start scheduling with other agencies to get it deployed. And then probably see my time spike as far as support goes.
Ron, do you have an estimated date for when that e-filing is going to be done? It's just
they were hoping for June, but because of delays and problems, they're saying now we're hoping for July. I'm thinking probably August, September.
Okay.
I remember one of the launch dates was in August last year.
Oh, right. That's true.
Right.
So I don't know what's going on in the background, what their troubles are having. I just get a report that they're saying they're just really struggling to get things working. And they've actually changed the process a couple of times, so they had to almost start over. The courts have.
All right.
So that's kind of where we're at, if there's any questions.
And so, okay, y'all, yeah, any questions for Ron? So as he said, his support is going to go up, and as you know, Ryan said, he gets within an hour a response. And as you see in my summary here, one of the federal auditors said, "What are you going to do when Ron retires and/or is sick and/or doesn't show up to work one day?" And I realized that that's not an issue that we have discussed yet. Is per the contract with Journal, we need to have only one person, a project manager, that is the go-between between UPC and our clients, which is you all, and JTI. And I don't know what the answer is. Do we contract? Do we hire one of your all support personnel, or do you have enough funds that you can dedicate, one of your IT people to be the backup for Ron? But I mean, really think about it. I mean, Ryan, so if we lost Ron, Ed, if we lost Ron today, I have no idea. I mean, there's really nobody that is going to be able to do what Ron is doing. And so that's a real concern that we have to address. Yeah.
Make yourself indispensable. That's all of our goals, right?
Well, it wasn't my purpose to do that. Just as a note, retirement won't be an issue because I will give plenty of notice before I leave.
Right.
And we'll train somebody before I leave, so that's not going to be an issue. The issue is, at a point, is what if I'm up hiking and fall off a cliff or something?
And you're assuming we actually ever let you retire.
Well, that's a big assumption, I know.
So, again, I'm not looking for a solution today. So maybe, Ed and Scott and Ryan, those that are on the committee, maybe that's something that you guys talked about in one of your meetings, but I think we certainly are going to need to discuss it when we, either in June or definitely when we do a retreat, is decide how we're going to provide for a backup for Ron, whether it's we contract with somebody, then, as an additional cost, or how we're going to do that. But we can't, I mean, we really are in a very vulnerable position right now if we were to lose Ron tragically, so...
Just one thing I thought of with that is we could find somebody from one or two of the offices could be trained. I could go in and train them to do what I do and show them how to access the resources and stuff, and then talk with Journal and tell them that these are backup people in case.
Right, and I think
Journal, that they would be perfect. I think they'd be perfectly willing to accept that.
Right, and I think Journal would be fine with that. It's just it's like I was saying. Is are you guys generously donating that person to be that person, or will we want to contract, and pay an hourly fee or however we want to do that? But that's just something that you all will need to decide. That's what I'm saying, is if the committee, if you guys will talk about it preliminarily, and then let us know what the committee thinks, and then as a council, we need to address that and have a plan in place.
One thought that comes to mind is, instead of being an individual, what if you contract with, you know, with an entity? I mean, you know.
And that might be fine. It's just, you know, with JTI, we just have to designate. And so if we say it's this entity and he's the project manager point person, I think that might be okay with them. We just got to have somebody as a backup for Ron.
But the issue becomes, again, this whole CDI thing. Whoever does it has to be approved, has to be a vendor that's already gone through so they can access this information has been approved like Ron has been. So yeah. I my brain's exploding from all the CDI stuff.
Yeah,
I'm
that too. Is
there an entity that has an in-house IT department that you guys work?
That's what I was thinking. I mean,
we have a phenomenal crew at Layton. I guess it's not me anymore.
We've got people who've been working on trying to get ours.
One owned by the county.
Right, and I agree, Jeff. I think that's a great idea. I haven't thought about Salt Lake. Is ultimately, and I'm just thinking out loud here, is when essentially we're going to have the same or similar product to what Salt Lake has. And I don't know if you guys are using, you know, more than one person in your IT department.
Right now we are.
Yeah.
But once it goes live, the idea is it'll drop down to one.
Right. And so maybe that's what we look at. And so I guess that's what I would suggest the committee, Ron, you and your committee, is maybe reach out to Salt Lake County and see if there's somebody there that we could use either on a contract basis. But committee members, I guess that's what I would suggest.
There's some suggestions we need to look at.
Yeah.
What I was going to suggest, though, based on Utah County's issues, is that if they're managed and supervised by the prosecutor or the city county attorney, that's an advantage versus an IT director, because, you know, Joe Blow is working e-prosecutor, then next month they're working on some land stuff, and then right. 2 years from now it's something else. But if they work for the prosecuting entity, they have a lot more control.
Okay.
Steve, I don't know if you work for you guys or not.
They're our back end call.
There.
It's in the summary that I'll be sending to Sim after this meeting.
Okay.
It's hidden in the middle, but it's in there.
We're just about out of time.
Okay. Better get
to check. Maybe it's hidden at the end.
All right, SB 135.
Yeah, so SB 135, I appreciate Steve working with Senator Stevenson, who made amending UPC statute a priority. The highlights are that there are going to be two new council members appointed by OMPA. When I sent out the summary, Ed Montgomery had already been nominated and accepted. Yvette Rodier since has accepted. I guess my recommendation would be is, Barry, maybe invite them to step out in the hallway and have the council vote to approve OMPA's nominations.
Yes, please.
So you'll actually know what we're talking about you behind your back.
Right. and the recording is on, so you can always go back and listen to the recording.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Oh, we already got a motion to approve.
We'll just leave the door open.
Yeah, let's see. It was Will and followed by Stephen Foote. Okay.
So we've already got a motion.
A motion and a second.
Will? Yeah.
A motion by Will and a second by Stephen Foote.
Oh, okay.
Do we have any discussion about this? Everybody good?
I think it'd be great.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay.
I don't know if they...
Perfect.
He voted no.
All right. Thank you. We'll invite them back in.
We already talked about the council retreat.
Yes. Yeah. So I was just going to say, the top of page 6, that's kind of just review that. Those were the other practical changes. Really don't have any change. We've talked about the retreat agenda items. This was on from last month. I just wanted to move it forward so you're aware of it. Anyway, and that's the agenda, and I will seek your input weeks and weeks in advance just so that we're covering everything that the council would like to address. Okay.
All right, what about this grant request?
Okay, you can see the request, tab K there. I responded. It was just requesting a copy of the email that went out on, that I sent out on, I don't remember what day it was, October, well, it was whatever day is on the email that it got sent out. So I provided that, and my guess is that the Attorney General's office has provided that. Then there's the petition for judicial review. I don't really think that there's a need to discuss that.
Okay.
It's there. You can go online and take a look at that if you need.
Okay.
Okay, the Prosecutor's Center for Excellence Survey, not to be confused with the Center for Prosecutor Integrity. Chris Hammond is a director of that. Many of you have sat through her best practices presentations. She has a federal grant, and let me get to the details there. She and her group are working with researchers from the Justice and Security Strategies. It's a federal grant. What they are doing is surveying elected prosecutor offices across the country. Their focus is twofold. One, to look at the processes that are being used in the offices in terms of data collection and whatnot. And then the second thing that they're doing is identifying offices that have adopted innovative programs. There is a survey. It takes, there's a copy is in your materials. She's telling me it could take anywhere from 90 minutes to 2 hours to complete, depending upon whether or not the information is readily accessible. We're just looking for one point of contact in each of the offices. At first, I thought it needed to be you as the elected, or that's only going to the electeds or the counties, that it needed to be you to fill it out, but it turns out it can be anybody in your office, hence why I'm asking you if Marilyn is authorized on behalf of UPAA to make a decision. What my recommendation, well, first of all, is one, does the council want to be a part of this? And before you do that, because I'm talking faster now, my brain's not quite caught up. Here's a copy of, and I didn't make copies for everybody, but Louisiana has already participated in this survey. Here's a copy of the report that was generated based on Louisiana's participation in it. It talks about, you know, statistics reporting things, but then it also identifies three innovative programs that the state of Louisiana is doing. And if I didn't mention it, that's one of the benefits of this program, or participating in this survey, is for those counties that have innovative programs and things that you're doing, they will be reflected on a national level so that other offices, other states can see what we're doing. But going back, as I said, is if the council is willing to participate in this, I would ask that UPAA be the designees, and each, you know, somebody in the office, the admin staff, would collect this data, and we can get it turned in and submitted. But that would need council approval if we want to participate in that survey, in that study.
For those who attended, Salt Lake County hosted last fall a 21st Century Prosecutor Conference, and the Prosecutor Center for Excellence collaborated with us on that. They're a great organization. They are not like the hate group that was mentioned earlier. And they are really trying to help prosecutors be better and communicate the great things that we're doing to push back on the idea that we're just a bunch of corrupt members of the empire.
Mm. You looking for a motion?
Yes, if we could get a motion.
What do you guys think? Want some time to look at this? Ready to move? What do you want to
do? What does UPC gain from it, rather than her just getting the list and sending it out herself?
Well, it's UPC. We wouldn't benefit. It would be the state. It would be one gathering the information across the state. How are we doing in terms of cases, reporting, things like that, as well as highlight what we are doing as a state innovatively to share with other offices across the country. So it's just a way of highlighting our successes.
UPC is not an advocacy group. Having said that, next year there will be legislation on prosecutor misconduct or overcharging. And to the extent that we can present a document that says, here's the things that we're doing in Utah's prosecutors that are proactive, that are progressive, that are addressing the needs of the community, it will help in that advocacy effort.
I was talking with Chris Hammond 2 days ago, and she says one of the benefits of this that offices are finding is when you get asked, what kind of cases are you handling, or how many of these do you handle a year, how many of you would be able to say that? And she says, across the country, the answer is, I don't know, or they don't have reporting processes in place. And so she said, what the benefits of these offices that have participated is that they're identifying the lack of reporting. Now, with the prosecutor, it will now be very easy to gather that data, because that's one of the big advantages of the prosecutor. But she just says that the states that have done this and invested the time, it has been helpful, useful information for them, as well as, like I said, highlighting the good things that are happening.
Well, to follow up on what Will said, I mean, you know, you're down at the legislature, and all it is, you know, the definition of data is just multiple anecdotes, right? And so if we actually have